amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. from the Playing Footsie Show. I'm joined by Steve D. from the Playing Footsie Show. And this is the Playing Footsie Show. As you can see, Paul isn't here. But Steve is, and I am, and it's the end of another working week. It's June the 9th, Friday evening. It's a nice day outside. Steve, how's your week been, and how's the stock market been treating you?
It's been a pretty good week, Steve. Yes, not too bad at all, really. It's been a bit cold up north, though. We ain't had the warmth that everybody else has had, but apparently heat wave coming for Saturday and Sunday, which is great because I've got to cut the grass and cut the hedge, so I'll be absolutely burnt. Looking forward to a bit of warmth, Steve, because I'm thinking if I can get the grass and the hedge done by like 9:30, I'm going to be that annoying guy who's out with the lawnmower early on your first day off after work. But I get it all done, I could probably spend a whole day in the hammock because my wife's at work all day, so she won't be able to bother me. In terms of the stock market, though, it's been all right, Steve. I'm still sort of on Operation Slim Down, so I'm still like looking through my stocks, trying to figure out, you know, what I want to do with this, that, and the other. But I think I've got a plan now, Steve. I'll probably talk about it a bit more next week, but I think I've got a plan to get another 3 out of the portfolio, which will take me down to essentially 24 stocks and an ETF. So I think that's a lot more manageable than the 30 odd I had before this. So I think I'm going to be happier with that. The problem is, Steve, is that as we'll find out later on the show, I think I've stumbled across a stock that I quite like. So that's always a bit of trouble, isn't it, when that happens? And no doubt we're going to have some kind of crash, which is going to throw it all in the mire, because there'll be about 20 stocks all pinging off stock alerts that I've been desperate to buy, but not at this price. So I don't know, Steve. One of my big rises this week, I mean, the portfolio as a whole is up about 1.6%, which I'd take that every week from now until eternity, is Netflix again. Netflix has had a bit of a banging week, looking at it nearly 5% on the week now. And that's because, Steve, that the people have begun to fold already on their password sharing rule change that's coming. You know what people are like. We're not signing up for that. No, if I can't have it for free, I'm not having it at all. And they've all cancelled the service, Steve. And Netflix have said, oh, just by the way, sign-ups in North America and Canada have doubled over the last few weeks. So it sounds like people have folded like a cheap suit, Steve, and they're all crowding to Netflix, which is excellent for my pocket and not for Bill Ackman's. How about you?
Yeah, that's interesting to see where people are spending their money. That's a thing we're going to come back to in a little bit. Just to reaffirm the kind of maybe investing thesis that we have, or not investing, I guess, identity thesis that some people have, that we are in fact the same person at opposite ends of the country. My plan for this weekend is to mow my lawn, and we've currently got a hammock outside. Because what I've discovered so far is, so last weekend I had a bash at mowing the lawn for the first time since we got here, which involved discovering, one, the state of the lawnmower, and two, the size of the garden in terms of power cords. And the size of the garden in terms of available power cords is roughly double it. So I have mowed approximately half of a garden last weekend, and now acquired a longer power lead so I'll be able to reach the far end of it. It's an absolute jungle, and Mo is working quite hard to try and get through some of that, and in some cases giving up and deciding it needs a little bit of a rest. So I'm going to get the rest of that done hopefully tomorrow when it's blazing hot. It's forecast to be a heat wave down here as well. I would be playing cricket, but my finger's still broken, so I'll be spending that time doing the gardening, which will be fun for me, I guess. But it'll be nice to have it done. If I'd known that it was going to be a sort of half job on the mowing, I'd have mown a cricket pitch into the middle of the garden and just let it sit like that for a bit, because it looks like that would have gone quite well. Stock market-wise, it's been an up and then down week for me. So Tuesday, Wednesday, things went very, very well in terms of my portfolio. And Thursday, it all came back to where it started. And today, it hasn't gone anywhere at all. And I can't quite work out exactly what's happened with my individual stocks, because I'm back where I started pretty much exactly for the week. And most things in my portfolio look like they're down. So there's something I'm missing somewhere. I kind of think it might be Southern Copper, but Southern Copper isn't big enough to be outweighing. It's one of the smallest investments I have, Southern Copper, because it basically ran up and I got myself anchored to a price that I don't think we're going to see again in the near future. But that's up. I can't work out what else is up, particularly from the start of the week. I have other things that are up and in the green in general. But nearly everything looks like it's gone down since the start of the week, and somehow the portfolio is where it was. I did get a dividend this week, which will be making a bit of a difference. But that dividend was 2p, so it won't be making much of a difference. So that's been more or less my week in stocks, largely back where I started. I don't own Netflix, but you must be pleased about that.
Oh, yeah, very pleased. Yeah, I mean, it is nice, especially after last year when, you know, basically investing is about coming up with theses and watching them either take off or collapse. So it is nice when you actually get one right. I mean, 2022 was the year of pretty much everything went down. So every time you thought you had a plan in mind, it got sort of scuppered pretty quickly, or price in mind. It definitely got scuppered pretty quickly. So it is nice to see something, especially when, you know, somebody like Ackman, who is, you know, I might joke a lot that he likes to cry on TV a lot, but he is an investor that I respect. So when he turns around and says, you know, I've made a mistake here and I'm out, it does put the doubters on your ability and on your thesis as well. So it is nice to see it to get one over on Bill, I guess, if that's what I'm aiming at, Steve. But I've got a little tip for you as well, just before we do shuffle on a little bit. Get yourself a petrol mower, mate. I've spent ages with corded mowers. I've spent ages with battery mowers, and there's just, I drive an electric car, so I'm not gonna, you know, it's different. You know what I mean? Electric cars have the range and have the power and have everything else, but battery mowers and corded mowers are just the worst. Just upgrade yourself a petrol mower and a petrol hedge trimmer, Steve, with a harness.
Yeah, great big one, right?
Yeah, 4 meters. Go absolutely
4 meters. That is absolutely daft. I agree with you on the petrol mower thing. So the house we lived in before, interesting on the mower front. We had a petrol mower that was pretty good when we got in there, but it was getting towards the end of its usable life, and eventually it reached the end of its usable life. And we told our landlord, who was generally pretty good at replacing this kind of thing, and he said, right, oh, I'll go off and find you another one. And he went and got one at a car boot sale, I think, another petrol mower, which was basically fine. But so delighted he was at finding petrol mowers at car boot sales that he went and bought like another 5 of them, and sort of kept bringing more of them round and stuff. And I'm partly worried he might have driven the price of secondhand lawn mowers up, and petrol ones for the area that I live in. And secondly, I guess reasonably encouraged that I do think petrol mowers are better. It's on the list of things to get. It's quite a long way down the list of things to get. It's below stuff like a wardrobe and a kind of better mattress for the baby's currently sleeping. We're doing what's called a floor bed approach, which is basically where you put his mattress on the floor rather than putting him in a cot, because it's easier to settle him when you can get next to him rather than when you have to reach into a cot and try and put him back into a cot. He doesn't like that very much. But if you can kind of get alongside him and give him a pat, you go back to sleep again. So we're going for that. But it means that my wife is quite a lot of the time sleeping in there with him, and she would appreciate a better mattress than the camp bed type thing she's on. So basically, the petrol mower is below quite a few things. One point on Operation Slim Down for you, actually. I wonder, I kind of think you don't need to be in a hurry. I think in the very early days, you have more time available than you might think in the first few months, because they sleep a lot. There's not an awful lot you can do other than sit with them and basically read about stocks is pretty much all there is to do with a day. When they start getting to 7 months plus, a rough guess, and it varies from baby to baby, I imagine, then they start doing things like not conveniently sleeping when you want them to, and being a more attention-demanding thing when they're awake, and that sort of thing. So I reckon you've still got time on Operation Slim Down. I wouldn't be in a tearing hurry. Prediction-wise, I think there's only one prediction that both of us have so far. Your recession prediction is working, but we both, and Paul, decided we were effectively short house prices this year. We had, I think, an 8 to 10% range for them to come down from the start of the year or the end of last year. And so far, the two of us have decided to represent that thesis by betting on a brick company.
Yeah, pretty much, Steve. And I think I've got another one coming up later as well. So, yeah, to be fair to us, though, it has had a pretty decent fall up to this point. So I guess we'll see where it goes from here on, Steve. But just back onto the mowers. I don't want to go back too far. Back on the my dad is currently in the process of buying a new house. My mum and dad are in the process of buying a new house. And I think they've been swayed by the fact that they have this one house they've been to see has a beautiful back garden. I made the joke when I went to see it. I just said, you're going to need a ride-on mower when you get this. And there is a ride-on mower included in the sale, Steve, because as the guy rightly pointed out, how do you transport a ride-on mower somewhere else? Unless you're like moving down the lane, you just drive it down the lane. That's easy enough. But he isn't. He's moving across. He's moving up into Scotland, I think he said. So I don't know if I'd fancy driving a ride-on mower from Hull to Scotland. I think that would take weeks. So yeah, I hope the house sale goes through just for the paid sale of, I want to go drive that thing around.
That does sound like fun. That's a reason to buy a house, right? That it comes with a ride-on mower. And that seems like a pretty good... What happens when it breaks, by the way? Is it like having a massive hedge trimmer that you can't get rid of?
Probably have to ring Halfords, dear. Do they do ride-on mowers?
They probably do. I guess that's who I'd ring. I don't really know. In my case, I'd just pick things that are easy to throw away or tell someone else to do it, or both. But anyway, let's get on with talking about stocks. Or let's get on with talking about the thing that Paul was going to be on this show until about 2 hours ago, perhaps, when he decided that, no, he wasn't going to be on this show. He's got work to do. But he did give us something to talk about that he said would be the thing, his story for the week. Do you know what Paul's big news story for the week is, Steve?
Something to do with consumer spending.
Yes, it's the news that people buy things in shops. This is a thing that Paul has discovered this week. People buy things in shops. And there's been a recent sort of study into the way people buy things in shops, specifically things to eat. So it's about food shopping. And the report has discovered five things. I think you would probably have managed to guess every single one of them based on even having your eyes vaguely open about the macroeconomic climate. But watch us get 10 minutes out of this segment. Here we go. Here is the main points of the report from a company called Kantar. This is like a paid research company, by the way, that come out with this. People are shopping less often than they were pre-pandemic. This is by comparison to here. But they are spending more when they shop. So news, Steve, with the UK running at what has been sort of double-digit inflation, and I think now just about below double-digit inflation, and most of that coming from food and energy, people are spending more on food. Point number one. More of their shopping is in person now. The online thing has faded a little bit. I'll run through all of these and we'll come back to them one by one. So there's more in-person shopping and less than there was during the pandemic. So now people can leave their houses. They are indeed leaving their houses. Own label brands are doing well versus, I guess, kind of bigger, I suppose, Kraft Heinz-y type brands or Unilever type brands or whatever. I don't have anything more fine grained in terms of different categories on that. But in general, own label is winning. Discounters are growing faster than anybody else. So Aldi and Lidl are taking market share and growing their sales faster than any of the kind of bigger supermarkets you might be thinking of. And the other thing that's doing very well is loyalty schemes. So think Nectar points, think Club Card points, that you get the general idea. That's it. That's your bunch of insights, Steve. What do you think of those?
Well, I mean, it's nothing we wouldn't already know, would we? I mean, I saw one of the points was like, discounters are here to stay. And you're like, well, yeah, because like Aldi and Lidl are doing incredibly well. I mean, probably if we could get hold of their stocks, or we could have got hold of their stocks about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, they would have definitely been high on people's list of things to buy, because they've done a really good job of getting into the UK and muscling in on the... On the big supermarket brand, Steve. So yeah, there's nothing in here. I mean, people are buying less and spending more. Well, yeah, of course they are, because inflation's running absolutely rampant. So that's almost definitely going to happen. So I guess the shift to online is an interesting one. That's slowing down. I guess that's probably what we would call growth pulled forward. I guess we would have to see. One of the interesting things that came off the back of this, Steve, especially on the back of the loyalty schemes, was I don't know whether you realise that, which the consumer group have come out and said that Tesco's loyalty scheme might actually be illegal because they're not showing clear pricing. So it was very interesting to see them going into this, because I don't know if you've been in Tesco's recently, they've revamped it all. So you get X price if you're just a Joe Blogs off the street, and you get Y price if you've got a Tesco club card or a club card promotion through the app. So people are actually complaining quite a bit about that, saying that it's not fair. It is a misleading practice. So interesting to see that Which have already sort of pulled them up by that, and interesting to see where it goes from here on that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't want to go all Martin Lewis here, but I am a club card person, and I am aware that I get a different price on certainly some things for having a club card. The club card is, I've got the credit card version. That tends to be the credit card that I use for no really strong reason other than might as well do something that's got a kind of reward scheme attached to it. Can do it on the petrol thing, can do it on the food thing. Got a load of points that I think are probably just halved in value because they were saying they're going to convert things at, I think, 2-for-1 rather than 3-for-1 going forward, which is sort of annoying. But there's 20 million people in that club card scheme, Steve. So when I was looking for something to make of this, I thought, well, okay, look, this is a show about stocks. Let's talk about stocks. Tesco is the obvious kind of supermarket to think about here. And I've thought about Tesco occasionally at a fairly superficial level in the past. And I've thought pretty much the standard stuff you think about retailers, I guess, which is, number one, margins are terrible, basically. Number two, switching costs are basically non-existent. Number three, they have a big club card thing, which in theory gives 20 million people a reason to shop at a Tesco rather than anywhere else, because they don't have to compete on price with them because they'll get points, they'll get a benefit for doing it. Number four, that doesn't seem to work because they're still getting done by discounters all over the place. So when I think about Tesco, I kind of wonder what their kind of big advantage is supposed to be. They have a scale advantage. They have more outlets than anybody else, 28,000 of them or so across the UK. Also, not 28,000, 2,800 of them across the UK. 28,000. They wish they had 28,000. 2,800 outlets across the UK. And when I looked at market share on supermarkets in the UK, the discounters are growing. This is absolutely true. Aldi, Lidl are growing their market share faster than anybody else, but they're not really growing it off of Tesco, which is sort of interesting to me. So 5 years ago, Tesco's market share in groceries was 28%. In April, which is the most recent, because I think it's done quarterly set of numbers I could find, it was 27%. So yes, they've gone backwards, to be sure. And actually, they've kind of been up and down a little bit over the last 5 years around that kind of area. But they've not gone back very much. The ones that have gone backwards appear to be places like Morrison's appears to have gone backwards at quite a rate in terms of market share. And Waitrose has gone backwards a fair bit in terms of market share too. So I sort of wondered about Tesco. I mean, you would expect them to be a beneficiary of, if loyalty scheme things are where the action is in retail, you would think it has to be Tesco with a club card thing doing well here. But I mean, are they? I sort of wonder. I mean, the point of a club card thing is it's going to try and hook people back into your store. They're maintaining their market share, I guess. But I do worry about them with inflation.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think what we're seeing here is essentially what's known as shopping down, isn't it? So where people go from a high or medium priced item, they go down the tier list. So to be able to try and continue to afford that item, but obviously not pay as much of it. And that tends to happen when inflation is quite high, or when there's a recession, or when there's higher unemployment than you would expect. These things tend to happen. And that's probably what they're experiencing at Lidl and Aldi. But Lidl are also doing a decent app as well to try and get a bit of loyalty program in there as well. So they're trying to match Tesco on every level. So it is interesting to see this is happening. I think it is all an inflation linked event. The problem is whether it reverts itself, because this is the first time for a long time that the supermarkets have had to deal with inflation, and the fact that they are supposed to be quite resistant to this kind of thing and maybe not doing as well as Aldi and Lidl, I wonder if that stays or if that reverts back, and that could be a problem long term for the supermarkets. For me, I don't get involved in any of them because I think this is like busy fool work for me. You could sell like $1 trillion worth of gear, but if you're only selling it at like 1.5% margins, it's just really not that interesting to me. And the fact that Tesco's have to branch into banking and mobile and all these other services to try and make some bloody money out of the thing. It worries me a lot. So they're just not the kind of companies that I am particularly interested in. Is there any of them, Steve, that you would consider buying? I don't think you own any, do you?
I don't own any. When we talk about discounters, I suppose the obvious discounter is Costco, right? Which we have talked about in some significant detail. And I think both of us think quite highly of, despite them being a retailer of a sort. There was a time when I looked at Sainsbury's and thought they were trading below their tangible book value, which was kind of interesting to me. But then I thought, actually, I wasn't convinced Yahoo Finance, which is what I was looking at, was exactly putting the right numbers into the right kind of slots there, which it sometimes doesn't, basically. So I wondered about that. And there was talk of Sainsbury's as a takeover target around that time as well. It was about the time that the aircraft wheels company that I've now forgotten the name of was getting taken over by somebody from the States. So that's that was something that was going on around that time. On the subject of the shopping stuff, it's mainly not me that does our shopping, which is makes a couple of points here. One is that I'd forgotten about the Lidl loyalty thing because it's my wife who does the shopping, her who knows about the Lidl stuff. We do shop in Lidl, and it feels to me a lot like Lidl and Aldi nowadays are not your grandfather's Lidl and Aldi's anymore. When you go in there, it is largely the same stuff, just either price matched or cheaper. There's branded stuff in there. I was in Aldi the other day and I recognized a lot of that stuff. They make not Mars bars, but they sell them next to Mars bars. And I think that's a sign that there's more power in brands than people think there is. I think where stuff's getting squeezed out of, you mentioned people are shopping down. I think people might be shopping downwards in some case into the kind of packaged foodsy stuff that we're familiar with as branded, away from, I guess, your kind of nice higher end premium organic-y artisan stuff. I wonder whether that's the kind of stuff that's getting, it's certainly stuff in our house that's coming under pressure. The stuff that has a kind of nebulous eco-ethical connection thing it's being marketed on and charging you three times the price, that stuff is struggling to make a case for itself in our current cost of living increase.
We've sort of seen that, though, haven't we, in the consumer goods companies too, because they've had basically sales dropping by a few percent but obviously getting in a little bit more revenue, usually under the rate of inflation though, but they've been usually getting a little bit more revenue just to you know, make up some of the difference. So perhaps that is, in the UK specifically here, is some of what we're experiencing, where people are shopping down, maybe buying a like branded product at Lidl or Aldi. And let's be honest, like their packaging is almost to the point of trying to confuse you into buying it, thinking you're buying the actual thing. They often have names that are like Cadbury's and things like that. That's something crazy to like, and they're in a purple wrapper and you think, God dear, they are really skirting the lines of what is possible. And I mean, let's not get down the Colin the Caterpillar level, Steve. That would be, you know, that would, we could spend a whole hour on that, I assume. But yeah, I think that's what we're seeing in all the consumer goods companies. I think we're seeing this, I guess we could call it the Lidl and Aldi effect, as they just managed to push their brands under people's noses, and not everyone's going to swap. But it looks to me that at least a few people have either stopped buying in these consumer goods companies or stopped buying as much. And I think that's a worry for these kind of companies, because they're all supposed to be inflation and recession proof. And I don't know if that's necessarily the case. There's got to be a point. I mean, with ketchup and things like that, I think ketchup's like £5 a bottle. Now, there's got to be a point when people look at ketchup and say, look, I don't care if it's Heinz, I'm not paying £5 for it. And I don't know if that point sticks around forever, this inflation proof.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I was thinking of it more on the recession side of it. The point of these defensive stocks, that when you think of them, you think, what are they for? They are for times like recessions, and they are supposed to hold up better in recessions and various other things. And maybe they hold up better, but it's not as straightforward as thinking, makes no difference, people do the same thing. They're not utilities, put it that way, where people... the macroeconomic environment doesn't make any difference to people's heating and how much they kind of use it. Stuff like the weather makes much more of a difference, basically. By the way, one last thing on this. Thinking of Aldi, Lidl equivalent things, you know penguin bars, the kind of chocolate-covered chocolate biscuit bar things. Do you know what an Aldi version of a penguin is called, Steve?
Puffin.
It's a seal bar.
Why not?
Yeah, why not? They're really nice as well. They're basically the same as penguins. Pretty much identical. Wouldn't be able to tell one by tasting them. But they are seal bars. They've thought, yeah, let's just pick a nearby animal. Who is Pingu's friend? Oh, yeah, that's seal. There we go.
Love it. Perfect.
Okay, shall we talk about a consumer products company, Steve, since we're roughly on the subject?
Let's do it.
Good. That's about all the value I can extract from that particular bit of information from Paul. If you want to know what his thoughts on this are, by the way, drop him an email. He'd love to hear from you, or find him somewhere on social media. Diageo, which is probably, I think we're both agreed, one of the UK's best consumer products companies. It's a stock that we've talked about on this show before. I think most recently I was saying buying it was indefensible at a time when it was trading at a PE ratio roughly similar to Google. And I stick by the thought that I would struggle to buy it at a similar PE ratio to Google. But this came across my radar this week because I saw it come up as being at or near a 52-week low. And when you see good products and you think they're and you think they're overpriced, worth being open to the idea that you would buy them at a lower one. And so 52-week low on Diageo shares. And there's a couple of reasons why this has happened. There's a story. So I picked this up before their very recent news about the very, very sad death of their CEO, Sir Ivan Menezes, who has died after a short illness at the age of 63. He's been with the company since the beginning, I think, for around 25 years, been the CEO for 10 years or so. And despite that quite lengthy career with Diageo, that's a long time to be doing either the same job or at the same organisation. 63 is not a terribly long life. We make jokes about a lot of things, and there are some coming in this Diageo segment, don't worry. But this isn't something that we treat as nothing other than extremely serious and extremely sad. They did have an interim CEO in place at the time that he passed, so things presumably carried on. I mean, he was in hospital, I think, beforehand, but yeah. Serious note to start off the Diageo thing. That's not the reason shares hit their 52-week low. This happened before that. So just some quick numbers then for a moment, because numbers are fun. Shares hit 52-week low. Earlier this week, they came down to 3,304p, which is how we measure share prices in the UK. Their 52-week high was 3,960p. So that's down about 16.5% off the high. Why? Well, there are two main reasons, as far as I can tell. They've been coming down all that way. In January, they launched a trading report or a quarterly update or an earnings report or whatever you want to call it. And their volumes have been falling in North America. Their revenues were up 3%, but that was pretty much all price increases. Volume sales were down. The market did not take this very well. Their shares started going backwards. But more recently, the big story is that they are being sued by someone they are working with, someone called Sean Combs. You know who Sean Combs is, Steve?
Diddy, isn't it?
Yeah, he goes by the name of Diddy, a.k.a. P. Diddy, a.k.a. Puff Daddy, a.k.a. Parak Patel, a.k.a. The Stig, a.k.a. several other things. But that guy, who had various kind of collaborative projects with Diageo, mostly in spirits, because that's what Diageo do, is suing them over some of their joint ventures. Not much to joke about in this particular section either, but here's what it kind of pertains to. Combs alleges, and let's leave it at that as a verb for the moment then, that Diageo had been, via its marketing and distribution, not supporting that brand properly. That was his, collection of brands. They'd been marketing and distributing them and concentrating on neighbourhoods that were black, basically, or mostly black populated. So effectively, this amounts to an accusation of racism. Diageo are saying this is a business disagreement. Combs is saying it's a racist thing. He's got various things that apparently various members of staff have said. I'm not getting into the he said, she said about this. But the point is, this stock is down 16% while there's a lawsuit going on. And from the investing side of things, buying things while there's lawsuits going on can be quite a promising way to go. Warren Buffett famously bought American Express while they were in the middle of having a lawsuit, and that's turned out to be a great investment. So, Diageo share price, 52-week low. Any thoughts on any of this, Steve?
Well, look, it's not a stock that I follow at all. It's not anything that particularly interests me. As somebody who doesn't even drink anymore, it's very sort of like low on my list of things to look at. But the reason it was down, the reason I saw when I looked at why it was down was just because its cash flow generation has declined to such a degree. I found that was sort of thoroughly unimpressive, really, when I looked through this. I didn't think this was a particularly interesting balance sheet. The other problem that I think they've got, Steve, is being a company that does a lot of, tries to do a lot in the US. If you look at its actual USD revenues, if you were an American investor looking at this, they would look at this converted into dollars because that's what they will be able to make sense of, Steve. In 2013, they were doing about $28 a share. That's nearly 10 years ago. They're only doing $32 a share now because of the way the dollar has gone. They're going to look at this, Steve, and think, look, eventually I've got to get this back into dollars. That's not a massive increase in terms of what the company's making. Earnings per share, Steve, is up 80 cents for them, from $6.04 to $6.88. So here, there's not a great company for an American shareholder to look at. So back into British pounds, it looks a lot healthier. If you want me to just quickly do that, Steve. I mean, we're looking at 18.28 to 26.66. So that's a good sort of, what is that, 50-60% higher. That looks a lot healthier. Earnings per share, 3.97 to 5.61. I mean, that's not a double, but it's getting on for a double. That is a little bit more impressive. But I think the big problem with the British companies, the reason British companies look so cheap is that sort of dollar sort of denominated version of their earnings is not that impressive, and Diageo falls straight into that bracket. How about you?
I look at Diageo and I think I still think what I thought about it before, basically. So I had a look at where it was after that share price had come down. And I think it looks like a good business. They maintain operating margins between 20% and 30%. So that's more Coke than Unilever, put it that way, as a kind of comparison point. So their PE ratio is now down to 21, which is quite a bit cheaper than Coke. Coke's around 27. It's a bit more than Unilever, which is around 16-ish, I think, from memory at the moment. But okay, if we're comparing it to the thing with similar operating margins, good. Its growth still doesn't really look like it's there. When we were talking about Google and other comps to similarly priced things, because everyone was at the point of expecting rising interest rates and thinking everything was out of control with inflation and things that were previous favorites were getting hammered a bit, I'm looking at 10 years of compounded revenue growth and EPS growth of between 3 and 4%. And for a sort of 10-year CAGR, that's factoring in quite a bit. They had a bit of a nice run during the pandemic, and I think people suddenly got a bit carried away with them. But I'm not looking at that as particularly amazing. They've been buying back shares, but at about 0.8% per year, so nothing huge there. Dividends, 2 and a bit percent. You get to about a 3 and a bit percent return. That's probably going to grow because there's a buyback going on. It doesn't scream off the page at me. I mentioned the point before, but this doesn't look to me like a Buffett buying Amex at half the price type of deal, basically. It looks to me like a lawsuit that might go one way or might go another way. Arguably, if it goes badly for the company, it's still kind of grossly overpriced here, even at a 52-week low, but 21 PE ratio, it looks sort of okay at these levels, but I think I've seen plenty in the stock market at the moment that's better than okay, is my sort of takeaway. I have one more thought on this, but back to you for a moment.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. Yeah, it looks fine, but I think fine is not a reason to invest in something, is it? It's kind of like, I always feel like the people who invest in companies like this are the people who try to just invest in what they use. And they're like, I like Guinness, so I'm going to invest in this company. Or I drink Johnny Walker, so I'm going to invest in this company. And I don't think that's necessarily the best idea in the world. I know a lot of people sort of misquote Lynch on this, but he was just saying, like, use it as a use it as a basis to go out and look at companies and not buy the ones that are trading at, you know, 21 PEs and have scattered earnings and forward PH and see if it's a little bit worse, which might be that ROI screw.ai has got it slightly wrong. But I just don't know. It's one of the stocks I can't get excited about, and I don't think it would be a good investment. So I just don't really know why. I'd love to hear people who've got it in their portfolios. If you've got it, stick it in the comment section and tell me where I'm wrong. But tell me where you think this goes. I mean, it's evidently a growth by acquisition kind of business. So what is it going to go and acquire to make it a good return for you? I'm not sure I see it.
When Lynch said buy what you use, I assume what he really means is look at what you use, because you have a much better chance of understanding it than look at what you don't use. This is why I find myself in many cases hopelessly lost on things like telcos and things like cybersecurity and definitely things like AI. I find myself kind of hopelessly lost on at the moment. AI might work its way into my circle of competence, but that's going to be very much it coming to me, right? If it starts showing up in academia or something somewhere, I'll be able to make a decent stab of what I think the kind of likely prospects for that are. But I guess Lynch's reason for thinking you should buy what you use isn't because it's always a good buy. It clearly isn't. He doesn't know what you use, but he, I assume, thinks you have a decent insight into how that works, and then you will be in a decent position to make a judgment about it. And in the case of Diageo, it might well be that you're in a really good position to judge it's overpriced, or that this isn't a big enough discount to be worth it. Or I might be wrong, as might you. Here's my other takeaway from this, Steve. I know Diageo is not a stock you follow that closely, but you have a reasonably close eye on Adidas, I think. I'm not owning it at the moment, but it's a stock that you know sort of fairly well, if I've got you right there. Here is my other takeaway from this story, and it's roughly on a par in terms of insight with Paul's people buy things in shops story. So get ready for some deep thinking here, right? Celebrity Zoo, really annoying. And I'm not saying that Combs is wrong or in the wrong or anything like that here, but companies that get themselves into celebrity partnerships and tie-ups and stuff, it always just seems to be a nuisance for them. Either they're suing you, or they're getting themselves into trouble and bringing you into trouble with them. So as far as I can tell, Adidas has been working its way through any amount of Yeezy related stuff, which is Kanye West, right? Have I got the right company there?
Yep.
Or am I thinking of Nike? Good, I am thinking of the right company for the moment. All I see when I look at celebrity endorsements, and I get that they're probably important for marketing purposes, because if one bunch is doing it, then they've all got to be doing it. But in the most cases, all they seem to do is create trouble, either because celebrities themselves are useless, or because you don't get on with them and then you get into arguments with them and so on. And maybe unjustifiably, right? I'm not attempting to beat up on P. Diddy, Patel, Parik, Puff, man. But it does strike me that the more you get involved with celebrity stuff, the more you kind of, the more trouble you attract for yourself, almost inevitably, as far as I can tell.
The obvious one for this was Instagram, wasn't it, when they managed to bring the Kardashians on board, and then it was only a few months down the line that the Kardashians thought they basically owned Instagram and started holding it to ransom for things. So it's a strange kind of thing, isn't it? I think it's a bit of a one of those things that when I guess when you see celebrity endorsement, I know a lot of people's default is like, well, he or she is very popular, this will be very good, and this will be, but you've got to think of the pitfalls as well, of just what happens if they go absolutely nuts like Kanye did, and how are they going to get rid of the millions and millions of pounds worth of stock they've got in a way that doesn't involve a large fire. And I just think, yeah, it's strange. I don't know, Steve. I think this, I mean, it doesn't seem like an obvious tie-up to me either, this Diageo tie-up. So I don't know, Steve. I don't have a dog in this fight, so I find it really hard to have any interest in how it plays out, really. Would you buy Diageo if it dropped to a 15p? Is it on your radar? I'm looking at its chart, Steve, and I know that's a lazy thing to do, but it's been a long-term winner for the UK. It's surprised me how far it's gone up, but it does look quite wildly overpriced to me.
It's been a theme of my thinking today, actually, that there have been some FTSE 100 winners. I associate it as being a stock full of basically knackered companies that are either big farmers or consumer product, which this is. But actually, this has People have made money by owning Diageo shares, and that's not an accident, in fairness to them. It's a good company, does a lot of things pretty well. It's got a lot of the obvious things that you might want from a stock to invest in. I'm not sure it particularly stands out to me. I wouldn't mind owning this, but when I've thought about it before, I've long thought, if I could just get past the price, basically, everything else, I'm away. I don't really mind that it's alcohol stock. And that probably comes under sin in some broad sense. I'm fine with that. I don't really mind various other things about it. It's got a big scale advantage, quite like that about it. The brands are, it's got product leading brands in nearly every category it competes in, and has had for some time. So I'm not a massive brand enthusiast, but I do believe in them for Diageo, in fairness to them. Now I think of the celebrities thing as just yet one more thing to keep me awake at night. I still think I'd probably rather stick to the ketchup and beans stuff, because I don't think many celebrities are bringing out their favourite versions of this. I don't think Kraft Heinz really look for celebrity endorsement. Maybe I'm wrong. They sell most of their stuff in North America, but I'm not sure that's particularly their brand of a famous person ketchup or famous person beans, or anything remotely what you might call innovative, apart from, I posted on Twitter, they have a machine for mixing condiments together now in restaurants. You can have the Heinz thing has like random number varieties, by the way. That number of varieties they say is just completely made up for effect, because you know, they like to be about as factually accurate as we do. So they are now offering things into restaurants that will allow people to like mix and match their own condiments, which is about as far into innovation as I want them to go. So I think I'll stick with my packaged foods rather than my distillery drinks stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a strange system, isn't it? I'm one part looking forward to trying it, and two parts thinking it worked with soda, with things like was it called a Pepsi soda machine, where you could essentially get all the different types of Pepsi flavors into your cup. I'm just not sure I'm going to spend that much time fanning around with sort of mayo and ketchup to try and get try and recreate fancy sauce from Step Brothers.
So the only way I can think that's going to work is it's going to be cheaper for restaurants, because they're going to end up wasting less of it or something. But yeah, I'm not sure I particularly view that as that useful. I do quite like the soda machine, though. I'm not going to lie. I'm a bit of a fan of that in places like Five Guys or Popeyes or wherever else they have it.
We don't have either of those up here, Steve. We just have an Odeon that has it.
In that case, it's probably quite expensive for you as well. But anyway, enough of the UK stocks before we get onto some cinemas and the like. Paul was going to be here, and Paul is not here. This is, again, the pitfalls of getting into sort of celebrities. Have whoever thought it'd be a good idea to start a podcast with a guy who's mainly famous on YouTube for like wearing burgundy t-shirts or something? Anyway, that's another reason for my case against celebrity endorsements. On to stocks for Paul. Who is currently not here. I've got one, Steve, you've got one. We thought it would be interesting to try and present some stocks to Paul, because we don't see him very often these days. But alas, he isn't around. What have you got anyway?
I've got a pretty interesting one, Steve. I've got a small cap for you. It's a company called Cavco Industries, and that will give away absolutely nothing as to what they do. So I've done a short write-up for you, so I'll try and get some of the information and see what you think. So this is a company that designs and produces factory-built homes, so homes built inside of a factory and then delivered to site complete. These are sold through a network of retailers throughout the United States and now, as of last week, Mexico as well. So the products the company manufactures are sold under a variety of brand names, so you won't know any of these, but here they are: Cavco Homes, Fleetwood Homes, Palm Harbor Homes, Chariot, Eagle, and Fairmont Homes. And they're offered in a variety of, sort of styles, floor plans, and price ranges, and it's one of the largest producers of HUD code manufactured homes. Now, again, that won't mean much to you. It's kind of like a British standard code of sorts. It's a code that these buildings must be built to. So their mission, Steve, is to help families achieve their dream of home ownership whilst doing the best to provide solutions to the affordable housing crisis. So they have Currently, they have 4 manufacturing facilities. It's actually going up to 7 as of last week. So this is, I wrote this last week, so that is one of my issues with not updating it. So they have 7 manufacturing facilities. 4 of them are going to be in Texas, North Carolina, California, and Arizona. They've got 230 of these little retail outlets, and they serve customers in Arizona, California, Colorado, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Texas, and Utah. So each of the homes are built inside a controlled environment. They're at about a fraction of the time and cost of a site-built home. And they're actually fully customizable to what the customer wants as well. So pretty interesting. So got some figures for you, Steve. It's a small cap. It's about $2.4 billion in market cap when I wrote this this section a couple of days ago. PE and forward PE is about 10, so that's good. It's cheap, but it's bad because that shows you that earnings are probably not going to grow this year. It's got about $22 million in debt. $271 million in cash, so that's going to bring your enterprise value down to about $2.1 billion, bring your PE to enterprise value down a little bit as well. So, not expensive, not even expensive in the home builders category. And it's been one of those big market beaters, Steve, that we talked about with Diageo. It's up 36x since its IPO. And that's because the growth rates are really, really impressive. So compound average growth rates over the last 10 years for revenue is 17.5. For cash flow, that's grown at 40%. Earnings has grown at 48%. And book value by 15% all over the last 10 years. Crazy growth. And to put some meat on those bones for you, that means revenue in the last 5 has grown 2.5x. Free cash flow per share has grown 5x. And earnings per share has grown 6x. Net margins have trebled in the last 6 years, meaning this company is still focusing and still really good at screwing down costs. And over this period, shares outstanding are actually declining due to a pretty generous buyback program aiming to take out about 5% of the share count. There's only 2 analysts covering this stock, Steve. It's Wedbush and it's Craig Hallam. Wedbush reckons this is a $425 stock. Craig Hallam, they're a little bit more reserved. They're saying $357. Today's price is 282, and I think they could be right. I think, look, times are a bit tougher in the market, but Cavco has made a very, very good acquisition last year. It bought its rival Solitaire Homes in about $93 million all-cash deal. This brought them 3 extra manufacturing plants into the fold in New Mexico, Oklahoma, and in Mexico itself. It's also got 223 extra retail locations in the deal too. So this was meant to close at the end of this year, but they've actually managed to close it way ahead of schedule. And look, I expect it to be not just an immediate boost to that top and bottom line, but I think this is one that they can apply their manufacturing expertise to and further improve over time, which I think is great news for somebody who's going to be a long-term investor, because despite being near its all-time high, you can see from the numbers that there really isn't a lot of growth priced in. I've got a bit of a bear case for you here, Steve, but I think you could probably guess what I'm going to say. There's headwinds here. They're definitely here. And you can see that, Steve, there's been a decline in inventory over the last couple of months on the balance sheet. And this is probably because there's been a drop in backlog. So this is orders already in place and in progress. They've fallen about 34%, but the backlog is still $427 million. So it's healthy. They've got enough to work on. Again, this is a business that's exposed to credit tightening, and in the short term, this could cause some company headaches. If credit continues to tighten, then and there's a large recession ahead, then this might be one to just sit and keep a look at, see how it does. But I think this one is one of those kind of short-term pain, long-term gain kind of stocks. What do you think?
So you compared this a little bit when you mentioned it to me, to NVR, another stock that is, of course, entirely inappropriate for Paul on account of the fact that it doesn't pay a dividend. With that kind of buyback and that kind of growth and that kind of acquisition, I guess we should probably get to the important point first. It doesn't pay a dividend, I assume.
It doesn't, no.
No, it ought not to be paying a dividend. It's better if it doesn't pay a dividend. But nonetheless, Paul is not here, so we are forced to just take a moment's silence for the fact that this stock doesn't pay a dividend. End of moment's silence. Right, let's get on to the more serious stuff then for a moment. You compared this to NVR for me. It feels a lot like an NVR type thing. So here's the big distinctive thing about NVR that gets them an edge of a sort over the rest of the US, or most of the rest of anyway, the US house building bunch. Normally, house building is capital intensive. You have to sink a load of money into acquiring a load of land. Then you have to go and try and build a house on it. Then you have to try and flog the house and hope you don't get a downturn in the time in between, at least as I understand it. Anyway, with the way NVR works, they construct their houses and bring them to the land and then just dump them on there fairly quickly. But it means that they buy their land kind of last, that they will buy options. And once they're convinced there's enough demand, they will exercise their options, buy the land, stick the house on, collect their money, usually by sorting a mortgage and then selling that mortgage to somebody, and move on to the next thing. This takes out a significant amount of the risk because it takes out a significant amount of the time where you get caught holding land that you all of a sudden rising interest rates mean there's no demand for a house on. Kafka sounds like it has a similar kind of idea available to it here, right? If you're building houses, basically, or if you're kind of manufacturing houses off-site somewhere and then wheeling them out to wherever it is you're going to kind of put them, I'm guessing that means that they also, you said their balance sheet looks very strong, it's cash heavy. House builder, these things are generally cash heavy, although I think there's a lot of that that's tied up in sort of land and so on, but they have a similar kind of advantage to NVR here, I'm guessing.
Yeah, pretty much, in that everything here, though, is built to order. So they're not going to be building any houses and hoping that they can sell them. They're waiting for you to pop into their sales showroom to actually buy a house from them. They'll build it off-site and then they'll ship it to you when it's finished. So they've got really, in terms of land and all that, they have very little overheads. And if you wanted to play a sort of low-cost take on a booming housing market, then this might be one of the things that you might want to consider. Margins for Kafka, Steve, have been as low in the last sort of 10 years, have been as low as 3%, but they've been as high as 17.5% net margins. So these are this is a company that could potentially, if we get a nice settled property market, you know, steadily increasing property market, this is a company that could really turn the screw here, Steve, and really make some quite impressive profit for you. The flip side of it is that they've got all these brand new retail locations on coming on board. Do you want an extra, well, essentially doubling your retail locations just while you're going into a slowdown? That's a potential headache, but they've seen a lot of people. So basically, they have a sales pipeline that's quite long. So people tend to come into the showroom, get some information, and then over a period of time, they either make inquiries or eventually coming and start designing the house or get an idea of what something would cost. And it's quite a long pipeline. But they said in January they had a very busy time of people actually coming into their sales locations. So they're hoping that they've got quite a lot of people that will soon drop into the funnel. Maybe not immediately, but when credit starts to loosen, they might have a bit of a, in the way that we've had growth pulled forward, we're going to have growth held back. And that's what I think we could potentially be seeing with Kafka over the next sort of year and a half. So is it a great stock to buy now, Steve? It's at all-time high. It would be daft of me to go out and buy this one immediately, but I think this is definitely one to bang on your watch list and just see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, you said it as an all-time high. That is true, but it is also all-time big because it's never had this much manufacturing capacity before. So you get more for your money than... Okay, you have to send out more of that money, but you get more of it back than you ever have before. It's kind of lazy for me to call or try and compare this to a sort of baby NVR, but it is the way that I think a lot of people, including me, tend to think about things when we come across new things. We try and work out, well, what do they have that's similar to this other thing that I sort of recognize? So I'm kind of slightly apologetic, but slightly not. The acquisition makes a lot of sense as to how they went from 4 to 7 manufacturing sites in quite that time. Otherwise, it sounds like crazy expansion growth if you were kind of building all that yourself. And to my mind, the acquisition just comes down to, did they overpay for it? Because if they bought that with... and you said they bought it for all cash, so it's not dilutive in any way to shareholders. And it feels like the kind of thing that certainly will work itself out over time. It might be that if they've paid slightly high for it, it will be a while until they get much of a return on it. Okay. If they've paid a price that reflects the fact that we are heading into a kind of macroeconomic downturn for that kind of market, well, they may well have managed to get a bargain there. This is a good time to be doing this sort of thing. One more time back to the NVR thing. What they do pretty well is sit tight when there's nothing to do. And when there is something to do and prices are low and demand is fallen away, start buying things, mostly their own stock. But you could imagine perfectly well that buying your own stock as an alternative to buying something else would be a perfectly sensible and defensible strategy.
Well, there's another factor in there as well, though, isn't there? Because if you wanna compete with people in the US who are also doing this, one of the best ways you can do it is start building in Mexico, where the labor is a hell of a lot cheaper. If you can get the cheaper labor, which is going to be the vast majority of the cost of this product, we're taking materials aside, but if you can get the labor pretty cheap in Mexico and you can still ship it across, the shipping isn't going to cost you the end of the earth. I think this is quite attractive. So soon, could Cavco have a way of offering houses for cheaper than their competitors? Well, if they're not in Mexico, I would say almost definitely yes.
Okay. Onto my stock for Paul for a moment then. In some ways, it's kind of the opposite of yours, I guess. It's listed in the UK, it's quite big, and it's a stock that has been coming down quite a bit. So it's Glencore. Glencore is a mining company with a £54 billion market cap. It's down around 25% since the start of the year. Why is it down 25% since the start of the year? Well, price of the stuff it sells is coming down, pretty much. Copper in particular over the last 12 months is down 12%. So why the hell are we thinking we want to buy something where we're going to make less money next year? I guess it's similar in a sense of there may be a short-term headwind coming here. But look, all the noise around AI has got me thinking about other investing themes. I don't particularly want to run towards this AI wave just at the moment. Prices look expensive to me, and it looks like I'm making my way into quite a crowded trade, and I'm going to be trying to work out how to get out before everyone else does in some of these things. Nvidia, I heard someone from Goldman today saying, yeah, look, see, it's backed up by massive earnings growth. Not that massive, it ain't, to my mind, and not yet anyway. Nvidia looks expensive. I don't care what he says. What looks more interesting to me at the moment is that attention seems to have just fallen away a little bit from the drive towards renewables, but nothing about the underlying thesis for those stocks has particularly changed as far as I can tell. So the things are still there, which is governments still have their climate targets, they have their agreements they have to meet, they have to do a bunch of capex in order to get there, they have to try and reduce their carbon emissions by a certain amount. And so that's still the case, and the ways they have for getting there are still the case. There's questions around, and increasingly good questions, I think, about how much of your energy supply you can switch over to wind and solar, and whether that will eventually be the whole damn show with decentralized, like, solar panels on people's roofs, or whether we are going to be constantly relying on natural gas, but nonetheless getting a nice boost off some renewable stuff. Fair questions to be asked there, but I don't think anything there has changed particularly either. We're still looking at, broadly speaking, the same ideas around electric vehicles, wind generation, solar generation, transmission infrastructure to get it from the places where the wind blows to the places where people actually want to use it, especially in places like the US, which is mostly windy in the middle of the country and sunny in the middle of the country, and most people don't live there, they live out on the edges. So more so than in the UK, where basically everything is next to each other anyway. And the same stats are still true as well. So wind generation takes 3 times as much copper to build out as coal-fired generation. Solar takes 10 times as much. EVs use 2 times as much copper as internal combustion engine vehicles. Blah, blah, blah. Same stats you've heard for the last 5 years or so. But nonetheless, Glencore, massive copper mining company, has been down quite a bit. And it's down because the price of copper is down. That sort of makes sense. They're going to sell copper for less in the near future, so you're going to get less by way of returns. You're going to get less by way of dividend. This company does pay one. Exactly how much it pays as a dividend is a bit of a lottery in any given year and depends on copper prices. But mining stocks tend to have sort of reasonable dividends at any given moment. So there's that to consider here. So, given everything I just said, why the hell does copper price keep going down? Well, one answer you might give is demand is going down, and you would be wrong in that situation. I was listening to a podcast on this. Demand isn't really going down. China manufacturing reopening has put pretty heavy demand back on global supply. What's happening is inventories and massive destocking is happening. Inventories are shrinking. Copper is now down at basically critical levels. Why is that happening? Because everyone's expecting a recession. Well, everyone not called Steve D is expecting a recession one way or another. So there's less need for inventory stuff lying around. This is happening in copper, it's happening in oil, it's happening in loads of other things too. And that makes kind of good sense to that thought. But there's still the same long-term need for green capex, there's one of two things is going to be the case, I guess, as far as I can tell. Either Steve will be right, everyone else will be wrong, there won't be a recession, in which case there is going to be an enormous drive for copper, oil and everything else as people realise, oh, hang on, we need to do stuff, we need to build stuff, and we need stuff to make that stuff from. Or there is going to be a recession, and then it will end, and you'll still have a stock that will then be subject to a massive run in copper prices. So I'm expecting copper to have the a pretty good long-term upside here, and I think Glencore is a decent way of exposing yourself to this. They have copper mines all over the place, as far as I can tell. Their mines appear to be in Australia, the US, Chile, the Philippines, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. So if you like things in comparatively stable jurisdictions like Australia, tick. If you like things in comparatively volatile but very low labor cost jurisdictions like the DRC, tick. They also mine a bunch of other stuff to do with EVs as well. They mine zinc, they mine nickel, they mine that from various different countries as well, like Kazakhstan and the US and Quebec and Norway and Italy and various other places as well. So Glencore to me looks like a pretty big diversified miner thing. Pretty big diversified miners look cheap to me, but they don't look cheap for a very good reason. Copper prices have been going down, but the reason copper prices have been going down is just the result of inventories coming down. Inventories are getting close to critically low levels. I think that price has higher to go. I think Paul should go and buy Glencore, stick it next to his Rio Tinto stock, which God knows where he is on that, probably down because nearly everything he owns is. And then sit there collecting whatever random dividends come out of this stock for the next 10, 15, 20, 25 years, basically. Steve, what do you think?
I mean, I love Glencore and I love its storied history as well. And I fully, everybody who is any interest in Glencore needs to go check out their history. I was just having a flick through their news page there, Steve, and they'd put out a sustainability report. And I just thought, Mark Rich would be so mad that there was a sustainability report coming out of Glencore. I think he'd be really mad about a 46-year-old CEO in charge as well. I think that wouldn't go down too well. I think he'd probably stub a cigar out on his shoulder. Fantastic company. I love it. Commodity trading house as well. So when they say that they deal with, I think it's 60% of the world's zinc and 50% of the world's copper, they're not mining it. They will buy it and resell it if there's... Because companies, the way company trade works, it's not like someone in Britain rings up China and says, look, we could do with a bit of copper. Could you send it to us? They don't. They ring Glencore or somebody like that. They buy from Glencore. Glencore facilitates the trade. And that's kind of there. They're a broker for commodities, essentially. And they will go to the ends of the earth to make sure that, you know, Iranian oil in the midst of an embargo is accidentally marked, Kuwaiti oil or whatever can pass for the politics of the day. So, and that happens, Steve, and that's one of the things that you've got to take on the chin if you're going to be a Glencore shareholder. They got fined twice last year, $180 million for corruption in the DRC, and another $275 million for bribing African officials. So, this is one of the things you've got to understand about Glencore, is that this is going to happen. This is not an ESG investment. They're nuts. There's stories in a book called The World for Sale of people who work for Glencore turning up with empty suitcases and leaving with full ones to go to various African countries to try and facilitate oil deals and tricking Jamaican members of parliaments into giving away their oils at a 30% discount for 100 years to build them a hotel to try and attract guests. Absolutely crazy stuff that goes on in this world, and it's probably one of the sort of scariest and sort of darkest corners of investing you can get. But it's a great company, Steve. It's doing very, very well. They're top of their field for what they do. If you think that they can get out of this phase of corruption and maybe square up all these kind of issues, and then it's good. Trading a PE ratio that I'm looking here, Steve, of about 4, but that's because they had really abnormally high earnings next year. So I would say that normalizes at about 12, maybe 12.5. So I think that's probably about what you should pay for this. Steve, it's saying an 8.41% dividend at the moment, which for something like Glencore is pretty good. The only thing is that if you just swap onto that max chart, you will see occasionally Glencore likes to trade for about a fifth of where it is at the moment. And that's a drop of about 435p to about 80p. And it does do this rather often. It is a real... When the market slows down and when metals slow down, Glencore often gets stung.
I would agree with all of that. So the PE number and the dividend number I thought were both basically meaningless. I mean, they are low, but I think they're kind of artificially low, so I wasn't particularly wanting to make them part of a view here. It's a fairly obvious point to say, yes, it's a PE of 4. That's going to come off a bit if the copper price stays where it currently is, or if any kind of recession comes along. Yeah, it'll be up and it'll be down. I think that this is one where the earnings are going to come in lumpy, and you hope to make enough in the up times to make up for the down times, basically. And with a copper heavy, zinc heavy, nickel heavy mining thing, I think there's going to be more up years than down years, basically, is the way I'm looking at this. And I think they'll avoid going bust in the down years and make enough to make up for it in the up years. But that's roughly my thinking on this one. It's not the copper company that I and you own. I think the only copper stock that both of us own is Southern Copper. Or it's the only stock, sorry, either of us owns that's in copper mining. But that's a lot more expensive than it was when we first bought it. And I kind of wonder whether I might be looking for something else to go with it that helps me just spread that out a little bit.
Yeah, look, I said to you off air that if we get a Southern Copper as it is now and we get a Glencore ADP, then that is a straight swap all day for me. I will swap that for Glencore and I will hold it forever. But I just think they're going to come hand in hand because they're so intertwined now. If Glencore's ADP, I think Southern Copper's probably $30, Steve, and it's probably not the most obvious swap at that point, but... I mean, I love it. You've got to get the world for sale. You've got to read that book. It's an incredible book on the history of Glencore and its competitors, which will blow your mind, some of the stories that came out of that and some of the things they got up to.
Yet another book recommendation from Steve to finish our show.
I can do
off.
Another.
Go on. Give us one more.
I'm about 3/4 of the way through Genius Makers by, I think his name is Cade Metz, Cademetz. It's about Jeff Hinton, the British, I think he's from Oxford, so I think he's one of your sort. And he went over to America to teach the Americans about AI, worked for University of Toronto, out in Canada, did some stuff for Google, did a lot with DeepMind, and then he is the guy who has actually since left Google saying, I think I've made a terrible error, I think the AI is getting a bit scary. But yeah, documents the history of AI from its very, very inception through this man, Jeff Hinton, essentially, as he is trying to get people to adopt it. And yeah, it's a really, really interesting book called Genius Makers. I do recommend it. I think it's going to be a 5-star review on Goodreads for me, Steve, which I don't give them out very often. I am very tight.
Excellent. And enough mentions of AI to get us shoved up the YouTube algorithm, probably, hopefully, maybe. We'll see. Anyway, that's our show for this week. Paul wasn't here, sadly, but Steve and I enjoyed ourselves. We had a nice time talking about stuff. Hope you enjoyed listening, and we will see you next time.